and justice itself are being threatened, inside and outside the courtroom. Aborted knowledge. A certain professor who teaches students who aspire to become speech pathologists begins by showing them the development of the various organs involved in speech. When he shows his class an ultrasound picture of the development of the palate in an unborn baby, it is not uncommon for one or two women in his class to have tears in their eyes, or to say to him afterward that they have had an abortion and were very much affected by seeing what an unborn baby looks like. For too long, we have been led to believe that an abortion is the removal of some unformed material, something like having an appendix operation. The very expression unborn baby has almost disappeared from the language, being replaced by the more bloodless and antiseptic term fetus. Many vocal advocates who declare themselves pro-choice do not want women to have the choice of knowing just what they are choosing before having an abortion. Ferocious opposition has stopped the showing of pictures of an abortion in process, even in schools or colleges that show movies of naked adults performing various sex acts. Still photographs of aborted fetuses have been banned as well. The particularly grisly procedure known as partial birth abortion cannot even be referred to in much of the media, where it is called a late-term abortion, another bloodless term, and one that shifts the focus from what happens to when it happens. What happens in a partial birth abortion is that a baby who is developed too far to die naturally when removed from his mother's body is deliberately killed by having his brains sucked out. When this is done, the baby is not completely out of his mother's body, because if he were, the doctor would be charged with murder. There is no medical reason for this procedure, which has been condemned by the American Medical Association. There is only a legal reason, to keep the doctor and the mother out of jail. All this is smoothly covered over in the media by calling such actions a late-term abortion and refusing to specify what happens. Such patterns of determined evasions and obfuscations show that pro-choice in practice often really means pro-abortion. Knowledge is the first thing being aborted. Philosophical questions about when life begins may preoccupy some people on both sides of the abortion controversy. But the raw physical facts of what happens in various kinds of abortion have turned many others, including physicians, from being pro-abortion to being anti-abortion. One doctor, who had performed many abortions, never performed another one after seeing an ultrasound movie of the baby's reactions. With most other medical procedures, informed consent is the watchword. But when the issue is abortion, great efforts are made to keep choice from becoming too informed. Politically and legally, the abortion issue is too complex for any easy resolution. We have gone through a quarter of a century of bitter controversy precisely because the Supreme Court went for an easy resolution back in 1973 with the Roe v. Wade decision. Before then, various states had made differing efforts to wrestle with and balance the weighty concerns on both sides of the abortion issue. But Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun rushed in where angels fear to tread, with a one-size-fits-all decision washed down with the blatant lie that this was based on the Constitution. Far from settling things, Roe v. Wade has led to polarization and escalating strife all across the country, including bombings and assassinations. It has corrupted the media, academia, and other sources that are supposed to inform us, but which have instead become partisan organs of political correctness. However this highly charged issue is ultimately resolved, and there is no resolution on the horizon today, surely honesty must be part of that resolution. Political catchphrases like "a woman's right to do what she wants with her own body" cannot be applied to situations where a baby is killed at the very moment when he ceases to be part of his mother's body. One of the few signs of hope for some ultimate resolution is that most people on both sides of this controversy are not happy about abortions. The women who shed tears at the very sight of an unborn baby may not be politically committed to either side of this issue, but their feelings may be part of what is needed to bring opposing sides together. Gun control myths. Professor Joyce Lee Malcolm of Bentley College deserves some sort of special prize for taking on the thankless task of talking sense on a subject where nonsense is deeply entrenched and fiercely dogmatic. In her recently published book, Guns and Violence, Professor Malcolm examines the history of firearms, gun control laws, and violent crime in England. What makes this more than an exercise in history is its relevance to current controversies over gun control in America. Gun control zealots love to make highly selective international comparisons of gun ownership and murder rates. But Joyce Lee Malcolm points out some of the pitfalls in that approach. For example, the murder rate in New York City has been more than 5 times that of London for 2 centuries, and during most of that time, neither city had any gun control laws. In 1911, New York State instituted one of the most severe gun control laws in the United States, while serious gun control laws did not begin in England until nearly a decade later. But New York City still continued to have far higher murder rates than London. If we are serious about the role of guns and gun control as factors in differing rates of violence between countries, then we need to do what history professor Joyce Lee Malcolm does, examine the history of guns and violence. In England, as she points out, over the centuries, violent crime continued to decline markedly at the very time that guns were becoming increasingly available. England's Bill of Rights in 1688 was quite unambiguous that the right of a private individual to be armed was an individual right, independently of any collective right of militias. Guns were as freely available to Englishmen as to Americans, on into the early 20th century. Nor was gun control in England a response to any firearms murder crisis. Over a period of 3 years near the end of the 19th century, there were only 59 fatalities from handguns in a population of nearly 30 million people, according to Professor Malcolm. Of these, 19 were accidents, 35 were suicides, and only 3 were homicides, an average of 1 a year. The rise of the interventionist state in early 20th century England included efforts to restrict ownership of guns. After the First World War, gun control laws began restricting the possession of firearms. Then, after the Second World War, these restrictions grew more severe, eventually disarming the civilian population of England, or at least the law-abiding part of it. It was during this period of severe restrictions on owning firearms that crime rates in general, and the murder rate in particular, began to rise in England. As the number of legal firearms have dwindled, the numbers of armed crimes have risen, Professor Malcolm points out. In 1954, there were only 12 armed robberies in London, but by the 1990s, there were more than 100 times as many. In England, as in the United States, drastic crackdowns on gun ownership by law-abiding citizens were accompanied by ever greater leniency to criminals. In both countries, this turned out to be a formula for disaster. While England has not yet reached the American level of murders, it has already surpassed the United States in rates of robbery and burglary. Moreover, in recent years, the murder rate in England has been going up under still more severe gun control laws, while the murder rate in the United States has been going down as more and more states have allowed private citizens to carry concealed weapons and have begun locking up more criminals. In both countries, facts have no effect whatever on the dogmas of gun control zealots. The fact that most guns used to murder people in England were not legally purchased has no effect on their faith in gun control laws there, any more than faith in such laws here is affected by the fact that the gun used by the recent Beltway snipers was not purchased legally either. In England, as in America, sensational gun crimes have been seized upon and used politically to promote crackdowns on gun ownership by law-abiding citizens while doing nothing about criminals. American zealots for the Brady Bill say nothing about the fact that the man who shot James Brady and tried to assassinate President Reagan has been out walking the streets on furlough. Gun Control Myths, Part 2. Talking facts to gun control zealots is only likely to make them angry, but the rest of us need to know what the facts are. More than that, we need to know that much of what the gun controllers claim as facts will not stand up under scrutiny. The grand dogma of the gun controllers is that places with severe restrictions on the ownership of firearms have lower rates of murder and other gun crimes. How do they prove this? Simple. They make comparisons of places where this is true and ignore all comparisons of places where the opposite is true. Gun control zealots compare the United States and England to show that murder rates are lower where restrictions on ownership of firearms are more severe. But you could just as easily compare Switzerland and Germany, the Swiss having lower murder rates than the Germans, even though gun ownership is 3 times higher in Switzerland. Other countries with high rates of gun ownership and low murder rates include Israel, New Zealand, and Finland. Within the United States, rural areas have higher rates of gun ownership and lower rates of murder. Whites have higher rates of gun ownership than blacks and much lower murder rates. For the country as a whole, handgun ownership doubled in the late 20th century, while the murder rate went down. But such facts are not mentioned by gun control zealots or by the liberal media. Another dogma among gun control supporters is that having a gun in the home for self-defense is futile and is only likely to increase the chances of your getting hurt or killed. Your best bet is to offer no resistance to an intruder, according to this dogma. Actual research tells just the opposite story. People who have not resisted have gotten hurt twice as often as people who resisted with a firearm. Those who resisted without a firearm, of course, got hurt the most often. Such facts are simply ignored by gun control zealots. They prefer to cite a study published some years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine and demolished by a number of scholars since then. According to this discredited study, people with guns in their homes were more likely to be murdered. How did they arrive at this conclusion? By taking people who were murdered in their homes, finding out how many had guns in the house, and then comparing them with people who were not murdered in their homes. Using similar reasoning, you might be able to show that people who hire bodyguards are more likely to get killed than people who don't. Obviously, people who hire bodyguards already feel at risk, but does that mean that the bodyguards are the reason for the risk? Similarly illogical reasoning has been used by counting how many intruders were killed by homeowners with guns and comparing that with the number of family members killed with those guns. But this is a nonsense comparison because most people who keep guns in their homes do not do so in hopes of killing intruders. Most uses of guns in self-defense, whether in the home or elsewhere, do not involve actually pulling the trigger. When the intended victim turns out to have a gun in his hand, the attacker usually has enough brains to back off. But the lives saved this way do not get counted. People killed at home by family members are highly atypical. The great majority of these victims have had to call the police to their homes before because of domestic violence, and just over half have had the cops out several times. These are not just ordinary people who happened to lose their temper when a gun was at hand. Neither are most children who are killed by guns just toddlers who happen to find a loaded weapon lying around. More of those children are members of teenage criminal gangs who kill each other deliberately. Some small children do, in fact, get accidentally killed by guns in the home, but fewer than drown in bathtubs. Is anyone for banning bathtubs? Moreover, the number of fatal gun accidents fell over the years, while the number of guns was increasing by tens of millions. None of this supports the assumption that more guns mean more fatal accidents. Most of the gun controllers' arguments are a house of cards. No wonder they don't want any hard facts coming near them. Power to the parasites. It may be a landmark in the history of American business and of American society if Dow Corning's filing for bankruptcy is the beginning of the end for this corporation. Lawsuits for huge damages against the company for its silicone breast implants are behind this latest development. It is not that these implants have been proven to cause medical problems. Rather, it has been unnecessary to prove anything in order to get cases put before juries who are free to hand out other people's money in whatever amounts strike their fancy, in response to whatever appeals the plaintiff's lawyers make. Scientific study after scientific study has failed to turn up evidence to substantiate the claims made by those suing Dow Corning over breast implants. Meanwhile, back in the courts, judges and juries are handing out multi-million-dollar awards in damages. The fate of one corporation is not a major national issue, but what it implies about our whole system of justice has grim implications for the future of this country. As a critic said more than half a century ago, law has lost its soul and become jungle. That is even more true today. The media have a heavy responsibility in all this. Their willingness to serve as a megaphone for all sorts of politically correct groups and movements has sent them off and running like a pack of hounds after any business accused of anything by the radical feminists, the environmentalists, or other favorites of the anointed. The very idea that the burden of proof is on the party who makes a legal charge has gone out the window as far as whole categories of charges are concerned. This is nowhere more true than in so-called women's issues, but it is also true in racial issues, environmental issues, and other crusades pushed by strident activists. More than individual injustices are involved. A whole class of parasites has been created and sanctified, ranging from the panhandlers in the streets to the lawyers in the suites. You can believe that Dow Corning will not be the last of their prey. All over this country, doctors, local governments, corporations, universities, and many others are being targeted for lawsuits by attorneys on the prowl wherever there is money to be had. Anyone with a deep pocket is fair game. And many of these deep pockets are nothing more than a lot of much shallower pockets of taxpayers and stockholders. 2 centuries ago, British statesman Edmund Burke warned of the dangers to any society that promotes the idea that some of its citizens are the natural prey of others. Yet that is not only what the litigation explosion is all about, it is what all the political talk of the rich is all about. This is the age of the complaining classes, whether they are lawyers, community activists, radical feminists, race hustlers, or other squeaking wheels looking for oil. No society ever thrived because it had a large and growing class of parasites living off those who produce. On the contrary, the growth of a large parasitic class marked the decline and fall of the Roman Empire and the collapse of Spain from the heights of its golden age. Despite Karl Marx's use of the term proletariat to describe the working class, the Roman proletariat was not so much a working class as an underclass supported by government handouts. But the parasites in ancient Rome also included a large and growing bureaucracy. The Byzantine Empire and later the Ottoman Empire likewise developed over the centuries bureaucracies so suffocating and corrupt as to bring their eras of glory to an end. More than 1,000 years after the collapse of Rome, Spain used the wealth it extracted from its vast empire to support growing numbers of Spaniards in idleness. Not only were vagabonds begging everywhere, there were also large numbers of educated parasites with no skills to use to add to the country's output, but with big ideas about how its wealth ought to be spent. No small part of our social problems today come from miseducated degree holders who have nothing to contribute to the wealth of the society, but who are full of demands and indignation and resentment of those who are producing. A study of the decline of great societies concluded that disappearances of empires due to catastrophes have been extremely rare in history. Rather, they slowly but steadily corrode and crumble from within. There is usually a growing amount of wealth pumped by the state from the economy, while extravagances of fashion and license develop among the people. Does this sound uncomfortably similar to what we see around us today? Medical lawsuits. When a friend told me recently that he was going to undergo a painful medical procedure to see if he has cancer, it reminded me of a time years ago when I faced a similar prospect. The testing procedure in my case would have been both painful and with some risk of infection. Fortunately, it was a two-part procedure. The first part was uncomfortable, but not painful or with any great risk of infection. After a young doctor had put me through that part, an older specialist took over and examined the results, and he decided not to proceed with the second part of the test. When my wife asked me if that meant that I did not have cancer, my answer was no. "What it means," I said, "was that the doctor weighed the alternatives and decided that, since the chance that I had cancer was sufficiently small and the danger of infection from the test itself was sufficiently large, the best choice was not to go any further." My wife seemed not completely put at ease by that, so I added, "Like anybody else, this doctor can be wrong. But if it turns out that I do have cancer and die, I don't want anybody to sue that man. Nobody is infallible, and no patient has a right to infallibility." Since this was many years ago, apparently the doctor's choice was the right one. But how many doctors feel free to make such choices in today's legal climate, where frivolous lawsuits and junk science can lead to multi-million-dollar awards or settlements? After so many megabucks awards grew out of claims that babies born with cerebral palsy could have been spared if only the doctor had delivered them by cesarean section, C-section births rose sharply. But it did not reduce cerebral palsy. While the C-section births may not protect babies from cerebral palsy, they protect doctors from being ruined financially by glib lawyers and gullible juries. Those lawyers who claim that their big bucks awards don't add much to the cost of medical care are counting only the sums of money they collect. But needless operations and needless tests are not free, either financially or otherwise. Today, I cannot help wondering whether my friend is going to be put through a painful procedure for his sake or because the doctor dares not fail to do this test for fear of a lawsuit somewhere down the road. This is one of the hidden costs of frivolous lawsuits and runaway damage awards, quite aside from the sums of money pocketed by lawyers. When I was growing up, it would never have occurred to me that Dr. Cheney, our family physician, was doing anything other than giving it his best shot for the sake of our health. It probably never occurred to Dr. Cheney that we might sue him. For one thing, he knew we didn't have enough money to hire a lawyer, so that was out of the question in the first place. Trust between doctor and patient is not a small thing. Sometimes it can be the difference between life and death. Our laws recognize the enormous importance of that relationship by exempting doctors from having to testify to what a patient has told them, even if it is a murder case. To go to these lengths to protect the doctor-patient relationship and then blithely throw it away with easy access to frivolous lawsuits makes no sense. Neither does creating a massive medical bureaucracy to pay for treatments and medication, where that means that patients can only go to those doctors pre-selected for them by some insurance company or the government. One of my favorite doctors retired early and spent some time explaining to me why he was doing so. The growing red tape was bad enough, but the deterioration of the doctor-patient relationship soured him even more. Earlier in his career, patients came to him because someone had recommended him, and they came with a wholly different attitude from that of someone who had been assigned to him by an insurance company. He now found much more of a distrustful, if not adversarial, attitude that didn't do him any good or the patient any good. That may be the biggest cost of our current bureaucratic and legal environment. Passing in review. It was a classic line from the New York Times. "How America raises the children of inner cities may be the ultimate test of the country's political and economic arrangements." Apparently, if it sounds lofty and poetic, who cares if it makes any sense? America does not raise children. It has never raised children, and it is never going to raise children. No amount of verbal collectivization will ever change that reality. Perhaps it is too much to expect realism from an essay in the book review section of the New York Times, But it is gross irresponsibility to review books about youth crime in the ghetto by making all of America responsible. Personal responsibility may be anathema to the New York Times, but it is what is desperately needed to deal with the ugly violence that threatens the residents of black communities across the country. Not trusting its readers to get the Blame America message the first time, the Times essay repeats it endlessly. The alarming rise in violence is due to American values. The hoodlums and thugs aspire to embrace all the trappings of mainstream America. It is due to his American upbringing that a ghetto drug dealer went wrong. It was essentially American dreams that ghetto criminals were pursuing in order to compensate for the hurt of growing up poor, jobless, and outcast. Haven't got it yet? The essay closes by recommending reading about the very American dreams that lead ghetto youths into crime. Most black youths do not grow up to be criminals. Apparently, they must grow up in some foreign country and then immigrate here later. Most non-ghetto youths likewise do not grow up to be criminals. They must all be foreigners, too. More is involved here than a little irresponsible rhetoric. The steady drumbeat of blame society, hate America talk is all too typical of the mindset that has led to the destruction of both moral values and law enforcement over the past 30 years. No one has done more of that than the New York Times, though many others have added their voices to the chorus, including people in high places who should have known better. Like Attorney General Janet Reno in the Clinton administration, Lyndon Johnson's Attorney General back in the 1960s, Ramsey Clark, was convinced that the way to deal with criminal activity was to deal with the social root causes of crime. So was the Chief Judge of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, David L. Bazelon. So was Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren. According to Warren, the reason for rising crime rates was that for decades, we have swept under the rug the slum conditions that breed crime. Yet during those decades, the crime rate was going down, not up, as Warren's root causes theory would suggest. When Earl Warren became Chief Justice in 1953, the homicide rate in the United States was 4.8 per 100,000 population, the lowest it had been in four decades. Non-white males had a declining murder rate during decades of neglect in our disturbed society, as Warren called it. It was only after the Warren Court's judicial revolution in the criminal justice system that murder rates shot up and kept on rising. By 1991, the rate for murder and deliberate manslaughter was 9.8 per 100,000, more than twice as high as when Warren joined the Supreme Court, even though the new statistics did not count all the homicides that were counted in the earlier statistics. Maybe there was some plausible excuse for talking about root causes and our disturbed society as causes of crime 30 years ago. But we now have 30 years of experience to the contrary. During that time, there have been all sorts of expensive social programs, reduced law enforcement, and intellectuals making excuses for criminals. The soaring crime rates that followed the liberal nostrums of the 1960s have produced no change of mind. Liberals are often wrong, but never in doubt. They are still blaming social conditions, society, America. It will never occur to them to blame themselves. Does anyone seriously believe that excuse-making and counterproductive policies on crime are a favor to black communities? It is now so widely known and so well documented that black people are the main victims of black criminals that there is no room for honest misunderstanding on this subject. Is the well-being of black people less important than scoring ideological points or denouncing America? Those who respond to concerns about crime in the streets by talking about crime in the suites may score a verbal point. But urban residents in general, and black inner-city residents in particular, are not huddled in their apartments at night behind doubly locked doors for fear of being sold junk bonds. Are cops racist? In much of the liberal media, large-scale confrontations between police and people who are breaking the law are usually reported in one of two ways. Either the police used excessive force, or they let the situation get out of hand. Any force sufficient to prevent the situation from getting out of hand will be called excessive. And if the police arrive in large enough numbers to squelch disorder without the need for using any force at all, then sending in so many cops will be called overreacting. After all, with so little resistance to the police, why were so many cops necessary? Such is the mindset of the media. Add the volatile factor of race, and the media will have a field day. If an incident involves a white cop and a black criminal, you don't need to know the specific facts to know how liberals in the media will react. You can predict the words and the music. Heather McDonald of the Manhattan Institute does have the facts, however, in her new book, Are Cops Racist? Unfortunately, those who most need to read this book are the least likely to do so. They have made up their minds and don't want to be confused by facts. For the rest of us, this is a very enlightening and very readable little book. Ms. McDonald first tackles the issue of racial profiling by the police and shows what shoddy and even silly statistical methods were used to gin up hysteria. Then she moves on to police shootings and other law enforcement issues. Suppose I were to tell you that, despite the fact that blacks are just 11% of the American population, more than half the men fined for misconduct while playing professional basketball are black, and concluded that this shows the NBA to be racist. What would your reaction be? Wait a minute, you might say. More than half the players in the NBA are black, so that 11% statistic is irrelevant. That is exactly what is wrong with racial profiling statistics. It is based on blacks as a percentage of the population, rather than blacks as a percentage of the people who do the kinds of things that cause police to stop people and question them. A professor of statistics who pointed this out was, all too predictably, denounced as a racist. Other statisticians kept quiet for fear of being smeared the same way. We have now reached the dangerous point where ignorance can silence knowledge and where facts get squelched by beliefs. Heather McDonald also goes into facts involving police shootings, especially when the cops are white and the suspect is black. Here again, an education awaits those who are willing to be educated. People in the media are forever expressing surprise at how many bullets were fired in some of these police shootings. As someone who once taught pistol shooting in the Marine Corps, I am not the least bit surprised. What surprises me is how many people whose ignorance of shooting is obvious do not let their ignorance stand in the way of reaching sweeping conclusions about situations that they have never faced. To some, it is just a question of taking sides. If it is a white cop and a black suspect, then that is all they feel a need to know. The greatest contribution of this book is in making painfully clear the actual consequences of cop bashing in the media and in politics. The police respond to incentives, like everyone else. If carrying out their duties in the way that gets the job done best is going to bring down on their heads a chorus of media outrage that can threaten their whole careers, many cops tend to back off. And who pays the price of their backing off? Mainly those blacks who are victims of the criminals in their midst. Drug dealers and other violent criminals have been the beneficiaries of reduced police activity and of liberal judges throwing out their convictions because of racial profiling. These criminals go back to the black community, not the affluent, suburban, and often gated communities where journalists, judges, and politicians live. The subtitle of Are Cops Racist? Is How the War Against the Police Harms Black Americans. The Meaning of Law. Ellie Nessler is a mother of a sexually abused child who shot dead the man who was in court to face charges of being the guilty party. Strong feelings have been aroused on both sides of this issue. There are people collecting money to defend Nessler, and others who were denouncing the vigilante actions of people who take the law into their own hands. We all understand why people should not take the law into their own hands. A civilized society would not be possible if everyone did that. Unfortunately, many of those who condemn this woman have been strangely silent for decades, as all sorts of other people have taken the law into their own hands for all sorts of other reasons. For no one should taking the law into their own hands be more inexcusable than for judges, who not only know better, but who have sworn to uphold the law. Yet judges at all levels, up to and including the Supreme Court, have been applauded for deciding cases on the basis of fashionable social theories rather than the written law. Indeed, one of the reasons for the bitter frustration of people like Ellie Nessler is that courts have become a plaything of the anointed, rather than an instrument for upholding the laws of the land. The man she killed had already been convicted of sexual molestation before, and had been let off with wrist-slap punishment. Judges have made it increasingly difficult for American society to protect itself from anyone or anything by creating new rights out of thin air and by leaning over backward for the benefit of those with antisocial behavior. In short, judges have taken the law into their own hands, instead of carrying out the laws duly passed by democratically elected representatives, reflecting the concerns of a self-governing people. The pretense that judges do this to uphold the Constitution is wearing so thin that growing numbers of people now see this as the fraud that it is. For more than a century and a half after the Constitution was written, the greatest legal minds in the history of the Supreme Court failed to discover these new criminal rights discovered by intellectual lightweights and ideological zealots on the High Court during the past 30 years. Such judges have taken the law into their own hands, and that is ultimately why Ms. Nessler took the law into her own hands, to defend her child when the law refuses to defend him. Many of those who condemn her are all too willing to let judges play fast and loose with the law, provided they end up with politically correct decisions. When people ask for Supreme Court justices with compassion or with sensitivity, what are they asking for except people who will lean the way they want justices to lean? An even-handed application of rules is a demanding job and a heavy responsibility. Even an umpire cannot have compassion or sensitivity. He can either call them honestly as he sees them, or prostitute his profession by leaning toward pitchers or batters or base runners. When courts of law become courts of political correctness, those who suffer are not just those who lose particular cases. The whole society loses. Law exists for a reason, and that reason is not so that judges can indulge their own egos or flatter themselves that their squeamishness is a higher morality. American society today is polarized over the issue of abortion, not simply because people have different opinions on the subject, which they always have, but because Justice Harry Blackmun imposed his own social opinion under the dishonest pretense of discovering a constitutional right that no one else had ever found in the Constitution. He took the law into his own hands, and was roundly applauded by many of the same people who now condemn the anguished mother of a traumatized child. This same spirit of playing fast and loose with the law in order to impose a social agenda or make a statement has spread downward from the Supreme Court to other appellate courts and into the trial courts. Nothing has been more deeply embedded for centuries in the Anglo-American legal traditions than the notion that the accused is innocent until proven guilty. Yet there are both civil rights and antitrust cases where only a few flimsy statistics are enough to force the accused to try to prove his innocence. This perversion of the law is not only accepted, but applauded because it reaches politically correct conclusions. Radical feminists are in fact working hard to extend this presumption of guilt to those accused of sexual harassment. If we are going to condemn people who take the law into their own hands, let us start with those who are sworn to uphold the law, who cold-bloodedly decide to twist that law to their own purposes, not with an overwrought mother whose child has been victimized because the law was lax. Freedom versus Democracy. The only time I have left a courtroom with more respect for the law than I had going in was in a court in Hong Kong when it was under British colonial rule. The case involved a Chinese laborer accused of theft, an accusation with considerable circumstantial evidence behind it. This case was presided over by a crusty old British judge of upper-class demeanor and wearing the traditional white wig. He kept both lawyers on a short leash and let the witnesses know, too, that he had no tolerance for nonsense. It would be hard to find two individuals more different in background and status than the Chinese laborer on trial and the British judge in charge of the case. Yet race and class were not destiny, despite the current dogmas of our intelligentsia. What was clear from the outset was that the judge was determined to see that this man got a fair trial, no more and no less. In the end, the laborer was acquitted. One need only look around the world today, much less back through the pages of history, to see how rare and precious something as basic as a fair trial has been. Whether or how long such trials will exist in Hong Kong under the communists is another question, and a very painful one. Meanwhile, too many Western journalists continue to play the game of moral equivalence. There was no democracy in Hong Kong under the British, they say, and there is no democracy there now. Some hark back to the evils of 19th-century imperialism that led to Britain's acquiring Hong Kong in the first place. There seems to be much less interest in 20th-century totalitarianism in China that sent so many refugees fleeing to Hong Kong, among other places. Democracy and freedom are too often confounded. Britain itself did not have anything close to democracy until the Reform Act of 1832, but it had freedom long before that. The fundamentals of freedom, limited government, separation of powers, an independent judiciary, free speech, jury trials, existed in Britain for many generations before the franchise was extended to most males. The whole spirit and many of the phrases of the Constitution of the United States derive from British law and government. Just as freedom can exist without democracy, so democracy can crush freedom. During the Reconstruction era after the Civil War, blacks in the South had many rights that they lost when the occupying Union Army was withdrawn and democratically elected state governments took over, ushering in the Jim Crow era. Today, the confusion between freedom and democracy leads far too many Americans, including those in high places, to seek to spread democracy around the world in complete disregard of the circumstances of the particular countries. In some respects, we may be more dangerous to our friends than to our enemies when we pressure them to set up at least the trappings of democracy. Both freedom and democracy have prerequisites. When those prerequisites do not exist, democracy especially can be a house of cards. Whether in Eastern Europe and the Balkans between the two world wars, or in Africa in the post-war era, many newly created democratic governments collapsed into authoritarianism or worse. It is much easier to imitate the outward institutional forms of Western democracy than to synthesize the centuries of traditions that make those institutions work. Our insistence on at least a charade of democracy is dangerous in another way, to ourselves. Relations among nations, especially among the great powers, are not matters of personal friendship or international social work. Their primary goal is, or should be, the safety of the American people in a world that has always been dangerous, long before the Cold War came and went. We cannot go around the world acting like a common scold, however good that makes us feel or however well it plays politically at home. Nuclear proliferation is far more important than human rights pronouncements, and how much cooperation we get in trying to deal with dangerous threats like this may depend on how much political capital we have squandered by insulting other countries whose help we need. The British were very wise to have given Hong Kong freedom. But they may also have been wise in not attempting to experiment with democracy, where the traditions needed for it simply did not exist. Judicial Activism and Judicial Restraint. While there are many controversies over particular aspects of the law, the most fundamental controversy has long been over who should control the law and who should change the law. American intellectuals, since at least the middle of the 20th century, have overwhelmingly favored expansion of the role of judges beyond that of applying laws created by others to themselves remaking the law to fit the times, which is to say, making the law fit the prevailing vision of the times, the vision of the anointed intellectuals. Where the Constitution of the United States is a barrier to this expanded role of judges, then judges have been urged to interpret the Constitution as a set of values to be applied as judges choose, or updated as they think appropriate, rather than as a set of specific instructions to be followed. That is what judicial activism means, though verbal virtuosity has managed to confuse that meaning with other meanings. Judicial activism. Those who advocate a greatly expanded latitude for judges to interpret laws to suit the presumed necessities or spirit of the times, rather than being bound by what the words meant when the laws were enacted, seem implicitly to assume that activist judges will bend the law in the direction preferred by such advocates, in effect, promote the vision of the anointed. But judicial activism is a blank check for going in any direction on any issue, depending on the predilections of particular judges. While Chief Justice Earl Warren used expansive interpretations of the law to outlaw racial segregation in public schools in 1954, almost exactly a century earlier, Chief Justice Roger Taney had used expansive interpretations of the law to say in the Dred Scott case that a black man had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. It was the dissenters in that case who insisted on following the laws as written and the legal precedents, showing that free blacks had exercised legally recognized rights in parts of the country even before the Constitution was adopted, as well as thereafter. Intellectuals of the Progressive Era and later may well have correctly read the tendencies of their times for judicial activism to move the law in the direction of these intellectuals' goals and values. But that is neither inherent nor inevitable. If the principle of freewheeling judicial lawmaking becomes established and accepted across the ideological spectrum, then swings of the ideological pendulum over time can unleash a judicial war of each against all, in which the fundamental concept of law itself is undermined, along with the willingness of the people to be bound by the arbitrary dictates of judges. In the meantime, the sophistry of results-oriented judges can make a mockery of the very concept of law, including the Constitution of the United States. A classic case of judicial sophistry for the sake of desired social results was the 1942 case of Wickard v. Filburn, which established a precedent and a rationale that extended far beyond the issues in that particular case. Under the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938, the federal government had the power to control the production and distribution of many agricultural products. That power derived from the authority of Congress to regulate interstate commerce, as provided by the Constitution. Yet the law was applied to a farmer in Ohio who grew what the Supreme Court itself characterized as a small acreage of winter wheat for his own consumption and that of his farm animals. This farmer planted about 12 acres more than the Department of Agriculture permitted, but he challenged the federal government's authority to tell him what to grow on his own farm, when that produce did not enter interstate commerce or even intrastate commerce. The Supreme Court ruled that the federal authority extended to production not intended in any part for commerce, but wholly for consumption on the farm. The reasoning of the High Court was, one of the primary purposes of the act in question was to increase the market price of wheat, and to that end to limit the volume thereof that could affect the market. It can hardly be denied that a factor of such volume and variability as home-consumed wheat would have a substantial influence on price and market conditions. This may arise because being in marketable condition, such wheat overhangs the market, and, if induced by rising prices, tends to flow into the market and check price increases. But if we assume that it is never marketed, it supplies a need of the man who grew it, which would otherwise be reflected by purchases in the open market. Homegrown wheat, in this sense, competes with wheat in commerce. Thus, wheat which did not enter any commerce at all was ruled to be subject to federal control under the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution. Under such expansive stretching of the law, virtually anything could be called interstate commerce, which in fact became a magic phrase justifying virtually any expansion of federal power over the years, contrary to the Tenth Amendment's limitation on federal authority. In 1995, there was consternation in some quarters when the Supreme Court voted 5-4 in U.S. v. Lopez that carrying a gun near a school was not interstate commerce, so that Congress had no authority to ban it, though all the states had that authority, and most, in fact, did ban it. What made the vote close and the result surprising was that it rejected the long-standing practice of courts stretching the phrase interstate commerce to cover and rubber stamp virtually anything that Congress chose to regulate. Some judicial activists not only make rulings that stretch the law, but even go directly counter to it. A classic example of this was the 1979 case of United Steelworkers of America v. Weber. Section 703A of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 made it illegal for an employer to discriminate against any individual with respect to his compensation, terms, conditions, or privileges of employment because of such individual's race or various other characteristics. Section 703D more specifically forbade such discrimination in any program established to provide apprenticeship or other training. Nevertheless, a white employee, Brian F. Weber, was denied admission to a training program where places were awarded on the basis of seniority, even though black employees with less seniority were admitted, because racially separate seniority lists were used and racial quotas were established. That this was counter to the plain meaning of the act was not explicitly denied in the U.S. Supreme Court opinion written by Justice William J. Brennan. But Justice Brennan rejected a literal interpretation of the Civil Rights Act, preferring instead to seek the spirit of the act in Congress's primary concern for the plight of the Negro in our economy. Because that presumed purpose was not to protect whites from racial discrimination, the act was deemed not to protect Brian F. Weber, who lost the case. The emergence of this decision from the clear language of the act to the contrary was likened to the great escapes of Houdini in the dissenting opinion of Justice William H. Rehnquist. In all three of these examples, Dred Scott, Wickard v. Filburn, and Weber, the decisions reflected the results preferred rather than the written law. They are classic concrete examples of judicial activism. Unfortunately, the meaning of the phrase has been obfuscated in recent years and so requires some closer scrutiny. Judicial activism is an idiomatic expression whose meaning cannot be determined by the separate meanings of its words, any more than the meaning of the explanation hot dog can be determined by referring to a separate definition of hot and dog. Nevertheless, in recent times, some have attempted to redefine judicial activism by how active a judge has been in declaring laws or government actions unconstitutional. However, the Constitution itself is a limitation on the powers of Congress, as well as on the powers of the other branches of government. Judges have been considered duty-bound to invalidate legislation that goes counter to the Constitution ever since the landmark case of Marbury v. Madison in 1803. So how often they perform that duty is not solely in their hands, but depends also on how often others do things that exceed the powers granted them by the Constitution. The real issue regarding judicial activism is over whether the basis of a judge's decisions is the law created by others, including the Constitution, or whether judges base their decisions on their own particular conception of the needs of the times, or of social justice, or of other considerations beyond the written law or the legal precedents. There is another idiomatic expression used for the practice of a judge who confines his role to following the written law, judicial restraint, or following the original intent of law. Here again, the meaning of these terms cannot be understood simply from the separate meaning of each word. Judicial restraint means making judicial rulings based on laws created by others, rather than being based on the judge's own assessment of what would be best for either the parties in the case at hand or for society at large. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes exemplified this legal philosophy when he said that his role as a judge is to see that the game is played according to the rules, whether I like them or not. He also said, "The criterion of constitutionality is not whether we believe the law to be for the public good." But, since the judge who believes in judicial restraint makes the existing law the paramount consideration in deciding cases, that often means that such a judge must be active in striking down new laws which violate the restrictions of the Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land. In short, activity is not what distinguishes the judicial activist from the practitioner of judicial restraint, since these are just idiomatic expressions for different philosophies of carrying out a judge's function. Judges who base their decisions on the kinds of social, economic, or other considerations of the sort urged by Roscoe Pound or Louis Brandeis are judicial activists in the sense that has stirred controversy, whether they declare many laws or few laws unconstitutional. Although Justice William O. Douglas was a classic judicial activist in the sense of paying only the most token attention to the Constitution in making rulings based on his own policy preferences, the most famous example being basing his ruling in Griswold v. Connecticut on emanations from the penumbras of the Constitution, he nevertheless deferred to legislators who passed liberal social legislation, using language dear to the heart of advocates of judicial restraint, saying that the court should not be a super-legislature, but leave social policy to Congress and state legislators. But when the existing law represented social policy that he disapproved, Justice Douglas did not hesitate to intervene and declare it unconstitutional, as he did in Griswold v. Connecticut, even if he had nothing more on which to base his ruling than emanations that he somehow discerned coming from the penumbras of the Constitution, which not even the greatest legal minds, on or off the court, had ever discerned before. The high tide of judicial activism was the Warren Court of the 1950s and 1960s, when Chief Justice Earl Warren and a like-minded majority on the Supreme Court decided to remake social policy in both civil and criminal areas, almost invariably to the applause of the intelligentsia in the media and in academia. However, as justices with a more judicially restrained view of their role later went on the court, beginning with the Warren-Burger Court in 1969, many among the intelligentsia sought to turn the previous complaints about judicial activism against the new judges by measuring how active these judges were in declaring laws unconstitutional or in amending the precedents established by judicial activists such as those of the Warren Court era. Liberal journalist Michael Kinsley accused Antonin Scalia of judicial activism when Scalia wrote an opinion as a Circuit Court of Appeals judge, which, in Kinsley's words, overruled a major piece of legislation passed by large majorities in both houses of Congress and signed with a flourish by a popular president, as if these were things that make a law constitutional. Linda Greenhouse of the New York Times called the decision that carrying a gun near a school was not interstate commerce an exercise of raw power by the Supreme Court because in U.S. v. Lopez it invalidated a law that two houses of Congress and the President of the United States approved, as if other laws overruled by the Supreme Court as unconstitutional ever since Marbury v. Madison in 1803 were not also duly passed laws. Under the title Dissing Congress, a Michigan Law Review article said that the court in Lopez had taken an important step in developing its new version of judicial activism, under which Congress was accorded less respect for its handiwork. Senator Herb Cole likewise denounced the Lopez decision as a piece of judicial activism that ignores children's safety for the sake of legal nitpicking. However, the Washington Post took a more measured view in its editorial on the case. One would never guess from the senator's comment, for example, that most states already prohibit the carrying of weapons in schools. In fact, Alfonso Lopez, the San Antonio teenager whose conviction was reversed in this case, was initially arrested on state charges that were dropped only when the federal government took over the prosecution. Clearly, the invalidation of this statute does not leave the nation's children vulnerable at their desks, and it may cause federal legislators to think twice about rushing into every problem area without even considering nitpicking questions of federalism. Senator Cole was by no means the only lawmaker to argue in results-oriented terms, rather than in terms of constitutional limitations on federal power. Senator Arlen Specter said, "I think that crime is a national problem, and guns and drugs are the principal instrumentalities of crime." But liberal law professor Lawrence Tribe saw beyond results-oriented criteria in this case, as reported in the Chicago Sun-Times. "Congress has pushed the outer edge of the envelope rather carelessly," said Harvard Law School professor Lawrence H. Tribe, who noted that lawmakers did not present findings of a link between interstate commerce and the dangers of guns on school grounds. He said the ruling revealed that this court takes structural limits to Congress's power more seriously than people had thought, which liberals and pragmatists find dismaying. The new definition of judicial activism included not only failing to defer to Congress, but also the overturning of judicial precedents. In Linda Greenhouse's words, the Lopez case was the first time in 60 years that the court had invalidated a federal law on the ground that Congress had exceeded its constitutional authority to regulate interstate commerce. But judges take an oath to uphold the Constitution, not an oath to uphold precedents. Otherwise, Dred Scott and Plessy v. Ferguson would have been set in concrete forever. The Lopez case was by no means the only one that caused many among the intelligentsia to denounce the later Supreme Court for judicial activism on the basis of its having declared some law or policy unconstitutional. Professor Cass Sunstein of the University of Chicago lamented in 2001, "We are now in the midst of a remarkable period of right-wing judicial activism. This has produced, among other things," he said, "an undemocratic judiciary, when in fact an appellate court with the power to overrule laws passed by elected officials is inherently undemocratic," so that Professor Sunstein's complaint would apply to the Constitution of the United States itself, rather than to those who carry out their function under that Constitution. Yet Sunstein complained again in 2003 that the Rehnquist Court has struck down at least 26 acts of Congress since 1995 and is thereby guilty of illegitimate activism for, among other things, having struck down a number of affirmative action programs as well as striking down federal legislation as beyond congressional power under the Commerce Clause. According to Professor Sunstein, the Supreme Court has forbidden Congress from legislating on the basis of its own views of what the 14th Amendment means. But if Congress can determine the extent of its own powers under the 14th Amendment, or any other provision of the Constitution, then the Constitution